Welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, with my co-host, Ryan Gable. Welcome back. It's October 25th. And today is the last show in a little while. We're going to be doing a break, a reevaluation of the show. And there'll be more announcements about that coming up. But in the meantime, we wanted to do a few retrospect discussions today about very important things that have been talked about over the last little while. First of all, though, just for folks who know, after last week, of course, the day after the last show, October 19th, was the Canadian so-called election. And for those of you who don't follow the corporate media, the Tory government of Stephen Harper got apparently tossed out. About half the ridings in Canada switched from Conservative to Liberals, giving, Justin Trudeau, that's the new Prime Minister, yes. He is now the Prime Minister of Canada, and the Liberals have a majority government. Of course, they've all taken the same oath of allegiance to the Crown of England, the corporatocracy, and so nothing really has changed. And proof of that, if I saw a news item today, the infamous Bill C-51, which is actually bringing in police state powers into Canada, the Liberal government announced they will not be challenging it. They're going to make minor alterations to Bill C-51, for example, requiring that judges approve police state warrants whereby people can be arrested without charge. Getting a compliant judge to sign a warrant is not especially difficult anywhere in the world, and Canada's no exception. So there you go, the Liberal government, same as the Tory government. Another example of that, and I'm going to discuss with Ryan for a minute. There was an announcement today on the news. If you go to Global TV, they had a little news item about this. The CSIS, that's the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, that's the equivalent of the CIA, CSIS Foreign Ops under Bill C-51 will raise accountability concerns. Well, that's a polite Canadian way of saying that the CSIS is now joining with the CIA and MI6 to, it's now been given powers to subvert foreign governments to what they call derail threats to Canada using illegal acts overseas. Now, this omnibus bill, C-51, is allowing CSIS to do this for the first time in Canadian history. And to show you that Canada is actually worse in a legal sense than the United States, in the U.S., the CIA, despite all of its illegal activities in that, is still formally accountable to a Congressional Oversight Committee. The government still has some kind of foreign or a formal authority over the CIA. In Canada, that's not true. Under the original bill in 1984, appropriately enough, named year, 1984, when CSIS was created, and I know this because I was part of a big coalition back then to stop the creation of CSIS, CSIS is not accountable to anybody. The head of CSIS only has to make reports that he thinks are important on a periodic basis to the Solicitor General, like the Attorney General in the U.S., and that's it. There's no accountability. Well, now this unaccountable spy agency has the power to subvert foreign governments, assassinate people, derail anybody they like outside Canada and obviously inside Canada, under this new bill, C-51, that the new Liberal government is going to keep in place. So there you go. Canadian election, nothing changes, despite everybody's, you know, enrapture over this young Justin Trudeau, who happens to be the son of a known and convicted child rapist known Pierre Trudeau. Ryan, your comments.
Well, I have a lot of comments. First of all, I'm glad to be back on the show, and I know that nothing really changes, obviously, with these elections. It just sort of is a changing of the guard. It gives people this image to perceive as if something has really changed in the world, that things are going to become different because there's a new label, there's a new heir to the throne, when in reality things obviously stay the same. And I know that what's important, you mentioned that this guy is the son of a known child rapist. What was the name again?
Well, it was Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau. He was kind of like the darling of the progressive community in Canada, because he used to pose as a progressive politician, even though he was the one who brought in the War Measures Act in 1970, froze wages, and was a complete autocrat. So, you know, it's the same dynastic heritage that his father had.
That's absolutely the same exact type of dynastical connection we find here in the United States, where Barack Obama is directly related to the Bush family, even though he seems as if he's this guy that just came from a, you know, a rundown neighborhood in Chicago, when in fact he was trained by Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was trained in CIA tactics. He was trained in hand gestures and different forms of hypnosis. And these are all factual things that you can look up. So when you look at this dynastical connection and you look at the parallels, this is what's really amazing to me, Kevin, the parallels of what's happening just in Canada compared to the United States and the erosion of civil liberties. Just recently, we've seen the announcement this year of a CIA type black site that's operating in Chicago, which is a city that has some of the strictest gun laws, where they're taking, they've announced in the London Telegraph, over 7,000 people have been taken, have had their constitutional rights removed, essentially, have been denied basic, not just rights, but basic necessities such as food, such as water. They've been shackled to different locations in these black site buildings, denied their attorney, denied access to their family. And these are people that were simply protesting, exercising their right of free speech. And this is happening in America now. Of course, you go back to the NDAA. Americans are allowed to be arrested by the military for suspicion of terrorist activity, for knowing somebody who knowing somebody who knowing somebody who may or may not have been connected to terrorist activity. And then, of course, they never define what terrorism actually is. Basically, it's dissent towards the state. So when I see the parallels between Canada and the United States, I see this as an underlying agenda and not something that's just a simple coincidence.
Now, the thing to remember is that people often hold up Canada traditionally as, well, more liberal than the U.S., but the only reason it had to create that appearance is because so much criminal activity was going on in Canada. And don't forget, being part of this continent, Canada hasn't ever had to become that draconian, because they relied on the big brother south of the border to do all that. Perfect example was the Vietnam War. You know, people thought Canada took a neutral position about the war. In fact, Lester Pearson, the Prime Minister, was an ardent supporter of the Vietnam War, and the Canadian arms industry was the most profitable industry in the world when it came to the Vietnam War. More Canadian arms manufacturers were profiting off the Vietnam War than any other country in the world. So, I mean, it shows you that Canada and the U.S. have always done this kind of behind-the-scenes tag-team operation. In reality, because things are so much more off the radar here in Canada, the repression, it's actually more dangerous. You know, as we found with something like the genocide and other stuff.
But let us not forget that even though the CIA might have some type of oversight here in the United States, being somewhat accountable, even when the National Security Agency, when they broke all of these privacy laws, went into congressional hearings, they basically just denied that they even had the ability to do what was proved that they were actually doing, and they were able to get away with it. So keeping that, first of all, in mind, but also realizing that there are so many different black operations that take place outside of official channels, and most of the way people get money for this is by narcotics trafficking, guns trafficking, and of course the trafficking of children, which gets tied into the church and other corrupt institutions.
Right, and you know what you mentioned earlier, these black sites in the Chicago Police Department and that, the Immigration Service has had the same thing for decades in America. People can be held in immigration prisons and airports indefinitely. A friend of mine, Ira Zabarsky, was bringing in material from co-ops in Mexico, which were near the Zapatista regions that had been liberated. These were like free zones where the peasants were producing their own, you know, clothing and food and that. And so Ira was selling this stuff to support the independent sovereign communities in Mexico. He was stopped, even though he was a Canadian citizen, he was held in the Los Angeles immigration prison for 3 weeks without charges. He said some of the guys in there had been in there for years. This was back in the early 1990s, it was going on. And the Canadian ambassador didn't make any inquiries. There was no intervention by Canadian government, even though a citizen was being held illegally in the U.S. So this stuff is very old, as you know. And we know that one of the centers for holding political prisoners in America is the federal penitentiary in Duluth, Minnesota. I've had letters from people in that prison. I've had people who have been trying to get their relatives out of there. They say most of the prisoners in there are in there for political crimes, for thought crimes, for advocating, you know, common law courts, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. The name of this place in Chicago, for people that want to look it up, is called Homan Square, H-O-M-A-N. So if you want to do some research on that, for starters. But yeah, political prisoners, this is primarily one of the reasons people are being, quote unquote, disappeared, is for protests or political disagreements. People that have some sort of power in local communities, they're literally being dragged off, taken away, and taken to one of these black sites. I remember I think he was a U.S. Marine named Brandon Raub, R-A-U-B, I believe is how you spelled his name, or R-U-A-B if you want to look him up. And Brandon Raub was basically arrested and taken to a mental institution, an off-site sort of black operation site like the CIA runs, because he simply posted on Facebook a question about whether or not the events of September 11th were in any way orchestrated or allowed to happen by the U.S. government. And simply because he made a statement on Facebook posing a question, he was arrested and dragged off and put into a mental asylum until thousands of people protested this. And of course, he was later released. But of course, these 7,000 people that are detained in these black sites in Chicago, for example, nobody's going out and protesting this, and they're allowed to get away with it. And as now, Kevin, it's being put into the mainstream news, the London Telegraph reporting on this at least twice this year alone. Now it's becoming normalized. And now people are saying, well, these are criminals. These are criminals. And they actually reported 6,000 of the 7,000 were black, therefore giving you that war on drugs association that they must be drug dealers. So if you put in that perspective, the average person thinks, well, these are criminals. We don't need to waste vital resources putting them through some legal process. We should just lock them up, put them away. But the question then becomes, who gets to say what's illegal and what's not illegal? If we just subvert the rule of law, Kevin, and people are just okay with that, the average person just says, well, it's not happening to me. It doesn't really matter. Well, if you've given up your essential rights to free speech, to the right to protest, the right to defend yourself, the right of the press, if you give up any of those, or you allow those of your neighbors to be given up or taken over or taken advantage of, you might as well give all of them up.
Right. Well, you know, that's why with a lot of the work we're doing, we're more and more focusing on the need for people to organize locally. I mean, it's fine to put out calls like we've done for a new political arrangement in Canada called the Republic of Canada. We're finding that where people are most confident is when they feel that they can do something locally first. And, you know, we've been encouraging that at the local level. So that's really where a lot of this stuff begins. And I want to give
also
an example.
I think that what you're saying should be really important for people to understand that what you're advocating is essentially what the system is already doing, because they influence belief systems and they're able to roll out agendas at a local level. When you see something like Senate Bill 277 in California for the mandatory vaccination of children, that's not something that's rolled out in all 50 states at once. Most states will have that legislation, but then one state in particular pushes it, gets it approved, and when nobody protests, then the other states roll it out. And they did the same thing with the naked body scanners in Orlando, Florida. They were rolled out at one airport. Nobody protested, so they made two or three airports in Florida, and then when nobody protested that, then they rolled them out nationwide. So they're also coming at this from a local level, like the new Strong Cities Network proposed by Loretta Lynch, the new Attorney General in the United States, to combine all of these cities into a globalized form of government. So they're doing the exact same thing, Kevin. They're attacking this from a local level.
Right. Well, that's really important point. And I wanted to give an example of something that's happened recently that kind of illustrates these new techniques of the police state, the corporatocracy. There was a man named Yves Dubé, and I mentioned him, I think, in the last show or the one before it, working to educate people like other people have done, holding workshops in Quebec on common law and people's right as, you know, sovereign men and women. And he was holding these workshops, and he got targeted. And he was dragged before a Quebec court and charged with a number of things, including making threats to bailiffs, simply because Yves had said, look, if you jail me illegally, I'm going to sue you. That was considered a threat. And so on that basis, a Quebec judge ordered him to do 1,000 hours of community service. Well, he already was doing community service. And as part of the sentencing, now he now has a criminal record because of this, as part of the sentencing, Yves was ordered to surrender DNA samples to the court. Now, do you want to comment on this DNA sampling? Because I know you know a lot about it.
Yeah, I actually just saw an article the other day. It seemed relatively mundane to the average reader, probably, where the these like local, not local, excuse me, these kind of white collar criminals in this community were put before a judge, and the judge offered them the ability to give blood at a local blood bank, or they could have a full sentence and go to prison for however long a time, or by giving blood they could reduce their sentence. So that might seem somewhat mundane and not very important to the average person, but this is going on in a lot of different ways and functions that are much more totalitarian and tyrannical. And I'll give you an example of this. A couple of articles from the USA Today a few years ago reported, and this was primarily in Texas and some other places in the South, where the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, they come out onto interstates, onto roads that are sort of back roads, and they set up these checkpoints where you're not necessarily required to stop, but they offer people, say, $50, I believe what was the financial amount, the monetary amount, for people that were willing to give cheek swabs for DNA samples or were willing to give blood or plasma. And again, just like the Senate Bill 277 rolled out in one place, nobody protests, they make it nationwide. The naked body scanners rolled out in Orlando, nobody protests, they make it nationwide. Well, they have these voluntary locations where, hey, you're going to get your car stopped on the road. You don't really have to stop, but you can go through the checkpoint without really showing ID. But some people that want to, quote unquote, help, Kevin, they can give blood, they can give a cheek swab, they can give plasma, other forms of DNA, a hair sample, whatever the case might be, and you'll be compensated with $50. And people see that as, it's not mandatory, it's just compensation for my time, and I'm helping people who might need blood. But what they don't understand is that as the incentives for these checkpoints are removed and people no longer receive $50, maybe they receive $25 now. And the next time, maybe it doesn't become a monetary compensation at all. Maybe next time you have to stop and you have to give blood or you'll be arrested. And this is already being rolled out across the country where they're offering people these same types of incentives and then slowly withdrawing them to create Nazi-style checkpoints where you'll be stopped walking to the grocery store in New York and asked for your papers. And as a matter of fact, to give an example of that, in New York City, a couple of years ago, I think it was one of the Bloomberg policies where they had a stop and frisk policy for police where they could literally just go up to people in the street and say, you could be a terrorist. We're going to pat your genitals down.
Right. And they've actually, the courts in the U.S. have upheld the power of the police to do that. It was challenged. There was a big civil liberties movement in New York. Lots of protests against the search and whatever they call it. And it got struck down. The attempt to change it got struck down. That right of the police to do that has been upheld.
And another part of this that's really important to understand, Kevin, and I know you know this, is that sometimes you'll have, say, warrantless wiretapping under the Bush administration, and that was going on for years, even before Bush, back before Clinton, even the first Bush administration in the early 90s. And after a while, as that comes out, as well as Murdoch's News Corporation after 9/11 doing all of this spying, and it comes out that this was all being done illegally without warrants, what the courts eventually say is that, well, it's been going on for decades. Nobody's really got hurt. Yes, it was illegal. But look, since nobody's been really affected by this, at least perceptually on the surface, we might as well legalize it and allow them to continue doing it.
Right. Well, I did want to finish off a question about the whole DNA sampling, because why do you think this is actually going on? Why, for example, in the case in the Quebec court, did they require that Yves Dubé surrender a DNA sample? How is that going to be used?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, there was an advertisement, up in the subway systems of London a few years ago. It might still be there, I'm not sure, where they were saying, if you spit, or something like this, if you spit on the ground, just, hock a loogie, that they can use that to track you down through your DNA. Now, this DNA database was actually something in the U.S. that was really pushed, again, by the last Bush administration, where they required that most hospitals, take a blood sample, a DNA sample of children in the hospital without the consent of either one of their parents. And this collecting of DNA, whether it's through the court system or whether it's through hospitals or it's the collecting of information and metadata through the NSA and Verizon and AT&T, is first of all the compilation and complete profiling, a complete spectrum dominance of every single individual on Earth, so that one, you can sort of map out the future, so companies like Amazon and some of the other big corporations are able to sell you products, advertising, they know what you're going to click on before you click it, so Amazon says we can send you a package before you even order it. So it's a mapping of the future for financial, monetary reasons, for being able to predict what you're going to do before you do it, but it also gets into an area of not only pre-crime, but an area of algorithmic pre-crime, where now they can put all of this information, all of your data, into a computer system. And just like the movie Brazil, if there's one issue within the algorithm, then this one guy living down the street who's always paid his taxes, never done anything wrong, he can now be considered a terrorist because some computer system spit out his name. And since his DNA and everything that seemed very non-cynical when it was first taken, whether it was in the courts or whatever the case might be, now they can go after this guy. And let's say that a government agency going after somebody for an act of supposed terrorism or pre-crime before they supposedly commit a crime, they don't want to look stupid in a case where they know they have bad intel. So now they just have this guy's DNA. They can set him up and they can make him look like he's right. Done some horrendous crime.
It's interesting, too, because that movie that came out of Hollywood Minority Report was about exactly that. And it was showing pre-crime, the whole movement, they could map out who was going to do a crime and arrest them before it happened. It was almost being held up like that was a good thing. And that brought down crime and everything, you know. Anyway, of course, we know this is all totally unlawful. So in the last 5 minutes before the bottom of the hour, I just wanted to flag something that when we were talking about the Canadian election, we did write a commentary piece on this. People can look at it at itccs.org and kevinanna.com. That's the latest posting on both sites. Looks into, you know, some of the whole perspective on the meaninglessness now of voting, especially since the whole voting system is controlled electronically and can be programmed by a few people. But leading into the second half, Ryan, I wanted to talk a bit about new perspectives for the show, how up till now we've been very much a commentary and reporting and interview type of show, covering a lot of different issues. One of the directions really important to go in future programs, no matter, you know, where we're broadcasting, is the need to identify that it's a minority of people who we are working with in terms of those willing to become active. And it's very important to reach out and educate and organize that minority rather than simply aim the stuff at a wide general audience. What are your thoughts on that?
So instead of a shotgun blast, more of a precise surgical method.
Well, yeah, very much. And I think it's really required by the times we're living in because, you know, it's, when I was growing up in the 70s, becoming politically active then, it was a very different kind of system we're living under. And people's minds are still kind of based back there where they think they live in a democracy. And you know, it's become, for all the reasons we've said, very much a police state, corporatocracy. You only know that when it reaches out and grabs you, and you find that you're with many thousands of other people who are now being held illegally. So we need to aim our education at those people willing to be active in their communities. And I just, you know, think we should talk a little bit about that.
Right. And I think that you would agree with me if I say that when we do that, we should do it at about maybe a 75-25%. So 75%, we target those who are willing to do this already, who are already sort of on board, so we can kind of grow locally through a grassroots movement. But at the same time, we also still have to have a little bit of that shotgun blast in terms of educating the general populace, so eventually we can plant these seeds so they will grow into the same type of movement. Otherwise, people, if they're not informed of what their rights are, they're not informed that they are free, independent people, and they only become servants, they only become slaves when they acquiesce to a system of dependency and servitude. If they never are taught that, then they're never going to be able to break that paradigm.
No, true. And for that reason, just in that regard, before the break, I wanted to mention that in Oregon, the public TV network has been broadcasting a number of our different postings. And the public TV across the America can pick up these broadcasts. And in the future, I'm going to be posting commentaries, discussions and other things to put up on this Oregon Public TV site. And at itccs.org and kevinanna.com, there'll be material soon of how you can access through the Oregon Public TV these broadcasts and get your local public television to air them. This is another way, literally, to reach millions of people as opposed to simply the internet.
Tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down.
We're back. This is Radio Free Canada. Kevin Annett and Ryan Gable coming at you. That was Billy Bragg singing The World Turned Upside Down, talking about the diggers in England in the 1640s and one of our spiritual ancestors. Simple observation that we're all born with, and that the world was made for everybody, not just the people with money and power. That seems to be a subversive notion. Well, it always has been subversive to those with money and power, but to the majority of us, it's always been the dream, simply to take back planet Earth. Now, that's a lot of what we've been trying to do with the Common Law Movement, Republic of Canada, and a lot of these broadcasts are kind of going back to that theme. So, Ryan, I want to kind of get back to some of the substance of our vision. And, in the time ahead, how we, new ways that we can use the media, our own media, to get this message out in a way to actively organize people on the ground. And one of the things that we talked about was article entitled The Purpose and Nature of Our Struggle, which is posted at itccs.org and kevinanna.com. And it talks a little bit about this kind of this dance that goes on, this energy dance, when you're engaged with a bigger adversary. And Sun Tzu in The Art of War talks about this a lot too, how you can use the energy of an opponent in a very nonviolent way to redirect their energy to help you. And we saw an example of that in Canada, how we were able to do that with the institutions of church and state. The basic aim of what we're doing is we're creating a working counterculture that draws energy and power away from the rulers and their system. I wonder if you had any comments about that to get into this whole discussion.
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, first of all, I think when we start looking for new methods in order to, new methods, but, based off of old methods and the philosophy of Sun Tzu in terms of the Xi energy, using the energy of the opponent to sort of counter them without operating on their same wavelength, without operating on their same type of battlefield, by sort of creating our own battlefield, we can also, as I mentioned in the last segment, learn how the enemy essentially uses the local forms of community in the same way that we need to use the local forms of community. They start out at a local level and expanded outward to a larger, unified, universal, global level, and we need to do the exact same type of thing, but with a new type of philosophy. So as the system uses this in a selfish manner to gain power and control for paranoia, criminal reasons, for selfish purposes, we need to use the same type of, methods, but not for selfish purposes, for selfless purposes, for the benefit of all mankind rather than the benefit of the few, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. And, we kind of start with the observation. I know after working on this campaign about genocide in Canada for over 20 years, kind of at the end of the day, you realize, well, when you look at Canada now, the system as a whole hasn't changed. It's just adapted. It's kind of like the Borg in the Star Trek sci-fi series. The Borg adapt quickly to all of your attacks, and they use your energy to strengthen them. We're talking about doing that in reverse, where, for example, a protest of many thousands of people hand over their energy to a government by saying, please do this for us. On the other hand, by us doing what we did, which was really using guerrilla war tactics, we got them to act on our terrain. And I just want to read 3 points from Sun Tzu, which is very instructive. When people say, well, how did you get Ratzinger to step down, Pope Benedict? How did you get Canada and its churches to admit to something they didn't want to admit to, which is that they killed thousands of native children? There's 3 principles. Let me just read these out. 1, when I am few and my enemy is many, I can use the few to strike the many because those whom I battle are restricted, being larger and more unwieldy. their strength becomes their weakness. Okay? So make a note of that. We want to talk about this. Second, do not respond to the ground your enemy has prepared for you, but instead shape their ground. Then they have no alternative to be led by you as if it was their own idea. I like that one. I'm going to talk about that. Thirdly, hide the time of battle from an enemy and make what he loves and defends your first objective. By aiming and seizing what the enemy holds dear, their greater strength and plans are nullified, and they must stop and respond on your terms, no matter how small are your forces. Perfect example of that is when we went in and started occupying the churches. They went ballistic. They did not like us doing that because it was threatening their money and their prestige publicly. Any comments on those three points?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I have enough comments to last us a couple more shows. But just commenting on the last thing you said there, I think that's a really great point because I study what is called the secret teachings or the secret doctrine. So it's a more of a historical, scientific, philosophical viewpoint of religious teachings and dogmas throughout history. And it really explains what the churches are today, a mutilated version of these ancient beliefs and mysteries going back to Egypt and Greece and Sumer and before. But instead of standing outside of a church and explaining to people the true meaning of communion or the true meaning of the twin pillars within the church or the rose window, that really doesn't get you anywhere because that doesn't necessarily affect the cash flow of the church. So what you're saying is by targeting the heart, what Sun Tzu is saying, targeting the very essence of what makes these monsters or what allows these monsters to have their power, makes them now operate on your terms. So by addressing some of the darker elements of these institutions and by directly going into the trafficking of children, for example, the murder of children for these selfish purposes, once again, that again attacks that income stream that you mentioned and, of course, attacks what they love most, which is money, which is profit, which is power, and not necessarily the meaning of what they promulgate as religious teaching. So I think that's a really important point that you made there.
Well, you know, there's another simple way to do this, too, and you keep repeating your own truth over and over and over. You know, psychologists always show that you have to repeat something 6 to 7 times with an average person before it enters the deeper memory. And that's, of course, what advertising and the church and the governments do all the time. They keep, like the exposure of that image of the plane hitting the second tower on 9/11 over and over and over. So it penetrates people's psyche. What we did in Canada, I found out that over half the children had died in these residential schools. Back in 1998, I found that out from my documentation and research. I just did a quick calculation and realized there had to be at least 50,000 or more children who died over a century. It's simple math. And they acknowledged the death rate. So I went off their own, you know, published figures of the death rate. At first, nobody, you know, even acknowledged that. But every time I was on a radio show, every time I talked publicly, I talked about the 50,000 missing children. After a while, academics began picking up the 50,000 figure. And now it's talked about openly in the Aboriginal and academic worlds across Canada, how over 50,000 children died. That was shifting the graph field, the center of gravity over to what I wanted, what the fact and the truth showed. And eventually, the whole country came around. And now, June 3rd of this year, the New York Times published an article how thousands of children died in residential schools. That's because of a few of us, really one man, me, pushing forward over and over and over on that point. And the whole public media and the government had to come around because of the new center of gravity I was creating. So if, you know, we can do that on that one issue, imagine if everybody just stood their ground and kept repeating our truth over and over, the system does have to respond on our terms.
Yeah, to sort of actually parallel that and repeat what I've been saying throughout the show today, we go back and we look at the ways in which the system is able to control and essentially brainwash and mass manipulate the profane, mass manipulate the average population. And first of all, I'll give you a quote from the famous Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels, where he said, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. The lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield the people from the political, economic, and/or military consequences of the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state, or you could enter the church, to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for the truth is the mortal enemy of the lie, and thus by extension the truth is the greatest enemy of the state. And in terms of repeating those facts and repeating what we know to be true, Kevin, you say this, you see the same type of terminology used by people such as Eric Holder, who says that we have to, quote, brainwash people on guns, end quote, or George Bush many years ago when he said, quote, in my line of work, you've got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda. And of course, when they say truth, it is essentially the opposite of truth. It is a mutilated version of truth. But I think it's the exact same type of situation where operating on a local level as the system does and a grassroots movement can create this new sort of energy, this new sort of opposition to the system. And in terms of what you're saying, by repeating these facts, by repeating these truths, the system does exactly the same thing.
Right. Well, we're simply using that simple psychology. The guy who invented the public relations industry, Edward Bernays, he was a nephew of Sigmund Freud, not accidentally. And he wrote a book in 1929, Crystallizing Public Opinion, in which he wrote, if we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, is it not possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing about it? Can we not develop a true science of the engineering of consent? Now, that's what it's all about. They're engineering people's consent without their even realizing it. Well, the reality is we can do exactly the same thing, although we're very open about what we're doing. We are saying to people, we stand on the truth, the evidence, the hard evidence of these things. And for everyone listening right now who considers themselves part of this movement, I can't emphasize enough the need for this continual repetition of these simple truths to everybody through your own media, because that's how we start shifting public consciousness. And frankly, it's working. That's why they've had to respond in this big way to all of our initiative.
Oh, exactly. And as a matter of fact, in terms of people responding and being controlled socially, you talked about Edward Bernays there for a moment. I think it's really important for people to realize that there was one recent study done on this, but there have been several throughout the years. And this goes back to the time of Bernays and before, where in a grouping of people, if one person, doesn't matter who they are, doesn't have to be an alpha male figure, but if one person openly says that the answer to 2 + 2 = 5, then literally, even if the average person in that grouping knows the answer is 4, out of fear of being condemned or ridiculed by the herd, everybody also answers 5, even if they know that's the wrong answer. And that kind of social pressure, that type of social conformity, isn't something that these elite propagandists, these elite black magicians, these lords of misrule, if you will, have crafted, Kevin. It's just an understanding of the way society operates. So by understanding and learning how society operates to them, they're able to control the masses. Again, it's not something they're creating. They're using the energy of the masses to counter the masses. And in the same way, by understanding the ways in which society works and studying the very things they study, again, using what they use to control people, we can use that to counter their energy in that same form of chi and create our own new battlefield to use their types of weapons against them. And these are silent weapons, not literal physical weapons, of course.
Well, of course. And the thing to realize, too, is that it doesn't take a lot of numbers and it doesn't take money. You know, it's funny when you start working with people, their immediate concern is this, the concerns that have been drilled into their mind by the system. That is, oh, we don't have any money. We don't have any legal help. We better organize all that. The reality is we are our own experts. We can do this immediately on the ground, and that's where we need to begin, on our own communities, on these different issues, and we are our own experts. That's the whole point. So it's a matter of activating people, but activating them with an example. You know, it wasn't by talk that we shifted the focus on the whole genocide issue in Canada to talk about genocide and missing children. It was because we occupied churches. It's because we created a huge stink publicly, and we're embarrassing these people publicly. And we can't emphasize enough how important that is to do. Now, there's many ways to do that. You don't have to all be occupying buildings. But it comes down to showing a public example. It's got to be something real and living that people can say, okay, that's an alternative. I can join. It isn't at the level of ideas, which you get that idea if you stick on the internet too much, because the whole notion of activism has now become information sharing. And this is not what we're talking about. Information is where you begin. It's not where you end.
Let me ask you a question about, in terms of protesting, whether people are agreeing with what we say or not. A lot of the people that I talk to say, well, even though we have a quote-unquote right to protest or address the government for the issues that we have, what exactly is the point of the protesting? Does that do anything at all?
It only does something if you direct the energy not at the adversary, but at your own people. For example, you don't protest with the aim of wanting the government or the powers that be to do something for you. It's not a pressure tactic. It's a way to educate people and give people a sense of their own power. You look around and say, wow, look at all of us. Imagine if instead of just walking down the street with signs, we started pulling our money out of the system. We started forming small little communes where we're taking back the land and training our children the way we want them to be raised, growing our own food. I mean, imagine if the power of 100,000 people on a protest was put into pulling out of the system. I mean, that would multiply our effect, enormously. And so I would say the purpose of that kind of public action is to unite and educate and give people a sense of their own power. Best example of that that I've seen has been when we shifted, like during when we began to gather Aboriginal people to demand to know where these children were buried. After a while, we realized, well, the government and the churches aren't going to disclose that. We have to find that out for ourselves. So we began to go around and look for these sites, and that's how we got the invitation to come to Brantford, to the Mushhole Residential School, where the first dig began. 10 Mohawk elders invited us in on the basis of saying, look, we have to bring our own children home. We've got to bring those remains of those children home and find out how they died, and so we can put those people on trial who are responsible. So that's the way we activate people, by looking away from the system, not towards it.
Exactly, and of course, at the same time, educating ourselves. And I wanted to take a moment here to give an example. There was an article published about 3 years ago, something like that, about a book that was actually written by this scholar who showed how the royal family throughout history have literally drank blood. Queen Victoria, of course, Vlad the Impaler, Dracula, related to Prince Charles, and through that royal line, through the Bush family and whatnot. And they literally drank blood because they believed it gave them the ability to have everlasting life. So it has its meaning in the esoteric and the occult, but they literally did it. Now, of course, in this article and in this new book, the article proposed this idea and then says that even though it's backed up by facts, that don't worry, this was about 300 years ago, and as if they stopped drinking blood with the establishment of the United States. So my point is, these same types of issues that we have had in the past, Kevin, still go on today. Nothing has changed in terms of the elite class and the profane, the average citizen. And as a matter of fact, there's a really great book. It's my favorite book, hands down, of all time. It's called The Secret Teachings of All Ages. And in that book, it was written in roughly the 1920s, around that time, but it was compiled over many years. And it's a compilation of teachings that have been put together for hundreds and thousands of years. And in this book, the author, Manly P. Hall, says that black magic, which is basically selfish energetic purposes or selfish energetic means to attain these ends, that black magic dictated the state religion and paralyzed the intellectual and spiritual activities of the individual, demanding his complete and unhesitating acquiescence in the dogma formulated by the priestcraft, and that the pharaoh became a puppet in the hands of this Scarlet Council, a committee of arch sorcerers elevated to the power by the priesthood. And the point of that quotation there is that this is the political, social, elite class that we have today. It's not based in the origins of selflessness for all. It's based in the origins of selfishness for the few. It's the same elite class of the past operating today, and there's always been this struggle.
Right. Now, we've got 5 minutes left here, Ryan, and before the show ends. And I want to remind people that, yes, these crimes are still continuing. If you go to back postings of ITCCS.org over the last couple of years, you'll see testimonies from people who've witnessed these blood-drinking sacrificial rites of the Ninth Circle and the Catholic system and the others. So please check all that out. In the last 5 minutes, I want to remind people that we will not be on the air next week. We are reevaluating the program. We will be having announcements at itccs.org and kevinanna.com as to the new formats we're going to be using, including public television, other broadcasts, and other forms of media, as well as, you know, what you're listening to today. So please stay tuned to that. We're taking this to a higher level. We're not shutting down anything. We're looking for new ways to be effective in organizing the remnant, I like to call them, of those who are really carrying the destiny of humanity in their own hands. The ones, that minority, that creative minority that Sun Tzu talks about, and the Bible and all sorts of other people talk about, that are really the source through which the divine energy works. And we're going to be having postings and, if you like, mini sermons and lectures about this whole topic. But stay tuned for all of this at itccs.org and kevinanna.com over the next week or two. There'll be notices about this. I want to thank everybody for being loyal listeners to the show. We're going to carry this on, like I said. And if you want to write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com, for how to be involved, please do so. And the kanatarepublic.ca website as well. Ryan, any final thoughts or announcements?
Yep, absolutely. As always, even in the small break that we have here for Radio Free Kanata, every Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and every Sunday, so that means tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, my show, The Secret Teachings, will air, and you can find links to that at thesecretteachings.info. Tonight we are actually talking about the black magicians and the destruction and mutilation of the ancient mysteries and how that sort of plays out in the modern world and what we've been discussing today on the program. And I also want to let people know that next weekend we will be live and we will be able to take people's calls. And I wanted to end on a quotation from the Protestant pastor Martin Niemöller. He says, "First they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." I think that is vitally important for people to realize that if you don't stand up, not just for yourself, but for your neighbors as well, it's the exact same type of thing. You have to stand up for everybody's rights and declare independence as a free individual who has the ability to transform your life alchemically through a process of transforming this lump of clay, this confusion that we have in the world, into something of substance by educating yourself through the knowledge that is provided.
Thank you, Brother Ryan. It's been good to be on the show here with you, and we'll do more of it in many different other mediums as well. And I'm glad you used the Martin Niemöller quote, because he was actually a loyal Nazi who was a U-boat commander in World War I, but he was also a pastor of what was called the Confessing Church, which was the anti-Nazi Christian pastors who did not like the Catholics and the Lutherans and the others who got in bed with Hitler. They said, no, he represents the Antichrist, the attempt by the powers of the world to subvert the teachings of Christ. They broke off into this Confessing Church with Dietrich Bonhoeffer and others. A lot of them died and were killed for it, but they kept alive that notion that it's this divinely led minority who were the source of real faith and action in the world. And so we don't have to worry about numbers, brothers and sisters. We have to worry about our own glowing light inside all of us and how that leads us to stand with all of those who are being oppressed in the world. So Ryan and Don for BBS, thank you again for doing the show. There will be announcements again soon. And again, follow those websites, especially itccs.org, kevinanna.com, and write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Until we speak again, stay strong and stay clear always.